I'm here from San Antonio, and we got snow in front of the Alamo. I don't live too far, but man, you never think you see the day until you got snow coming down like this.
Things will likely get worse before they get better. There's a high chance the power will be out for these folks until the weather gets better, which will not be for a couple of days.
Do everything you can to be warm in a safe manner. I do not encourage people, for example, to try to leave their homes. The roadways and the streets are still very much treacherous. We have a number of warming centers throughout the city, but I would tell you even a couple of them are without power.
Our resources are really being stretched thin. We've had 56 fire calls over the last 24 hours, and we responded to over 90 calls for carbon monoxide poisoning.
The next few days are going to be very tough.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Cities across the southern United States experienced record low temperatures during a dangerous winter storm this week. So far, at least 20 people have died. In Texas, the state's electric grid was unprepared to deal with the bitter cold. And as a result, millions of residents lost power and have had to go without heat during the storm. The freezing temperatures and snowfall from this week's storm have also been particularly threatening for residents of these states who are experiencing homelessness. Some shelters have had to turn people away because of pandemic-related capacity limits. And in Houston, Texas, multiple warming centers have had to close after losing power. But Texas is not the only state facing these issues. Other states, including Mississippi and Tennessee, are also facing brutal winter weather right now, endangering many of their most vulnerable residents. We're going to check in with two reporters for what they're seeing. Paige Flager is a reporter with WPLN News in Nashville. Paige, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Joey Palacios is the local government reporter for San Antonio with Texas Public Radio. Joey, thank you for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Joey, tell us what you're seeing on the ground in San Antonio right now. Where are the power outages? Do you have power?
No, I have not had power for about 48 hours now. It all started, around 2 a.m. Monday morning when it was snowing heavily. And snow is not common in San Antonio. We got about 4 inches of snow, and that hasn't happened in more than 36 years. It started with rolling blackouts. Those lasted maybe like 10, 15 minutes at a time. Then they lasted hours. I haven't had power for more than I haven't had any semblance of power now for more than a day. So going on at least 48 hours now without anything reliable in my house. It's about 35 degrees. There's still freezing rain falling outside right now. So it has been, and I'm not alone. There's around 300,000 households and businesses that don't have power in San Antonio, up to about 4 million or so across the state. So it's a very widespread situation affecting a lot of people in Texas.
Joey, what are Texas state officials saying about the power outages? We're hearing reporting that it's unclear when the power is going to return to the state.
That's correct. And it's going to depend on the weather. You know, as I mentioned, there's still freezing rain. It was falling this morning, and things are going to have to thaw before things can get back to normal. One of the major problems is that this icy cold weather where wind chills have gotten to -4, -6 degrees like here in San Antonio when this started, has taken some of the state's power generating capacity offline. The power grid manager in Texas is called ERCOT, and that stands for the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. And it's that agency that started issuing the mandatory calls for rolling blackouts when some of these generating capacities like wind turbines, natural gas, nuclear power, coal power, some of these just started going offline because those plants couldn't handle the cold. Some of the plants here were not weatherized for this type of cold. And as soon as some of these plants and units come back online, others go offline. Where there's an issue right now where natural gas is freezing. And so that gas that goes to power those plants isn't necessarily making it there. So it's this cycle right now of things coming online, going offline, and utilities and the power grid operator not having a clear answer of when things are going to get back to normal.
So, Paige, we just heard what Joey is dealing with over in Texas. You're in Tennessee. What are things looking like where you are?
Yeah, so it's definitely more mild than what's going on in Texas. There have been kind of intermittent outages in different counties across specifically mostly Middle Tennessee. And at any given time, there are a couple thousand people without power. But it's seeming like things are getting back up pretty quickly. Yesterday, there were a couple hundred people in Nashville, Davidson County, who didn't have power. And today they're reporting that that's down to only a handful of people. So it seems like in comparison to what's going on in Texas, Tennessee is definitely more mild.
Joey, who is feeling the impact of this weather right now most acutely? We know that in some cities in Texas, there is a mandate to house people, for example. But given the weather and given the extreme temperatures there, is that even possible right now?
So I can tell you that the city of San Antonio has set up a warming center within its convention center, and that took a little bit of time to set up. The convention center can hold about 500 people or so in this circumstance. That's how many people they'll be able to let in. And it took a while to set up because the city of San Antonio wasn't sure which facilities would be able to hold on to power long enough to be able to care for that many people. Our power utility here is called CPS Energy. It's municipally owned, and the city has gotten pretty much a guarantee from CPS Energy that the convention center is not going to lose power. We've seen these blackouts in different parts of the city almost randomly. I mean, it really depends on what circuit somebody is on and whether that circuit is connected to hospital or other critical infrastructure as to whether that power gets shut off. It appears my house is not connected to any of that such critical infrastructure. And this warming center that I mentioned, you know, they have COVID precautions in place. They're making sure that people aren't too close to one another. The state has also set up some emergency warming centers around as well. But my understanding is that not one of those has been set up within San Antonio. They're in different parts of the state. That's why the city has its own center right now. And even before all of this started, the city started working with some nonprofits, some churches to be able to house folks that are homeless during this, even before these power outages started. And the city does also have its own massive homeless shelter called Haven for Hope, where people are being housed as well.
Paige, in Tennessee, in Nashville in particular, what are efforts looking like to take the most vulnerable residents there and get them into shelter?
So it's interesting. I kind of assumed as a northerner who just moved to Tennessee that there might not be enough space in different shelters here in Nashville to take care of people who are unhoused during this weather. But the answer was quite fascinating, which is that were it not for the COVID pandemic, things might have been in much more dire straits. But during the middle of the pandemic, the city government here turned the fairground facility, the old fairgrounds, into a shelter. And so they've been taking care of people down there who don't have housing. And as a result of that, they were able to kind of expand that space to take in people during this cold weather as well.
And Paige, what are officials in Nashville saying about the weather? I mean, how is it expected to improve? Is it expected to get worse?
Yeah, so it's expected to stay quite cold for the rest of the week. And I think we saw kind of over the weekend as this stretch of cold weather has gone on, more folks without housing have been seeking shelter. But by this time next week, it's supposed to be in the 50s. So it won't hold on for too long. But the city is really definitely very proud of the fact that they have enough space to take care of people in the meantime.
Joey, how are people dealing with the cold? You know, you mentioned that this was the first time in 36 years that there'd been a storm like this, but how are people just generally trying to deal with the cold if there's no power?
So I can tell you right now that I have a sweater, a jacket, a robe, two pairs of pajama pants, and I'm covered under two blankets right now. So it's a lot of self insulating. And, you know, I can tell you that people, like, one of the things that I've had to do because the power has been out for so long is the food that I have in the fridge, it wasn't going to stay cold for very long. There's still snow outside, even though it snowed 2 days ago. The snow hasn't melted yet. So to protect some of the food that we have, I put it basically in a bin, and it's sitting outside in the snow right now. We still have plenty of non-perishable foods. So, you know, we don't have any issue with food right now, but we've seen photos of grocery stores, some that are actually still able to open. We know that some grocery stores haven't been able to open, but their shelves are bare, even more bare than when the pandemic was first starting. The convenience store just down the street from outside of my neighborhood, its shelves of all the snack foods are also bare. And even the gas at that convenience store, there's no more regular and there's no more super. It's only premium right now because there's people that, you know, even though the streets are filled with ice and it's absolutely advised not to travel anywhere, people are having to go into their car to warm up, to charge their phone. I've had to do that several times, and I'm definitely not alone in that because, you know, people that I've asked on social media are doing the same thing, making trips to the car in short bursts to get some semblance of heat.
Joey, that's not sustainable. I mean, and I think so many people are looking at this situation and thinking, how quickly is Texas and San Antonio and other parts of the state going to be able to dig out of the storm? What are you hearing from officials right now about, I mean, were they prepared for this? Were there not trucks with salt on the ground? Like, were there any areas where the state and local government could have done better?
You know, from the perspective of somebody on the ground, it feels like there could have been a lot more done. But this is not a normal occurrence for Texas. This is something that, you know, people, for instance, don't have ice scrapers in their car. They don't have the normal type of winter weather preparedness that folks in the north might have. And I think that's similarly here with local governments and even state governments, where snow plows are not readily available here.
And finally, Joey, has there been any talk about help from the federal government?
Yes. So just before the winter storm started, Texas Governor Greg Abbott asked for an emergency declaration, or a federal disaster declaration, rather, from the White House. And the White House did grant that on Sunday. So there are resources available from the federal government, including access to FEMA and other emergency management resources.
Well, we'll be paying close attention to see how this plays out. Paige Flager is a reporter for WPLN News in Nashville, and Joey Palacios is a local government reporter for Texas Public Radio. Thanks so much to you both, and please stay safe.
Thanks for having us.
That is the sound of New York City in the 1970s, and this week, the world lost a salsa music legend. On Monday, Johnny Pacheco, the renowned band leader, musician, and co-founder of the salsa label Fania Records, died at the age of 85. Widely considered the godfather of salsa, the Dominican-born Pacheco helped popularize salsa music internationally, with his label Fania eventually becoming known as, quote, the Motown of salsa. A Juilliard-trained instrumentalist, Pacheco joined forces with lawyer Jerry Masucci in 1964 to form Fania Records. The label had humble beginnings, selling albums out of car trunks in Spanish Harlem. But before long, Fania Records grew into the major label, recording and promoting the sounds of salsa, complete with its own orchestra, the Fania All-Stars. Over his decades-long career, Pacheco himself wrote and recorded more than 150 songs, earned countless Grammy nominations, and was inducted into the International Latin Music Hall of Fame in 1998. In August 1973, the Fania All-Stars sold out New York's Yankee Stadium for a legendary concert. And they even took the show on to Zaire in Africa.
Oh.
Fania landed some of the biggest names in salsa music, including the queen of salsa herself, Celia Cruz, whose career embodied the evolution of Latin music in the United States. Fania Records also spread the salsa and jazz stylings of famed pianist Eddie Palmieri, who fused American jazz with Afro-Cuban rhythms. The beloved Puerto Rican singer Hector Lavoe, as well as musicians Rubén Blades and Willie Colón, became hallmarks of salsa around the world, all thanks to Johnny Pacheco and Fania. As a New Yorker who grew up on this music, Johnny Pacheco and Fania Records was a constant part of the rhythms of the streets of New York in the 1970s. My family had stacks of Fania Records, and many of the songs would become staples of household gatherings. For many, Fania also represented the sound of a new chapter in the Puerto Rican, Dominican, and Cuban diaspora here in the United States. And now I'm joined by Bobby Sanabria, a multi-Grammy-nominated drummer, percussionist, band leader who works in the worlds of salsa jazz and Latin jazz, and he's also the host of the radio show Latin Jazz Cruise on WBGO. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Felix Contreras is the host of NPR Music's Alt Latino. Felix, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, too. Thanks.
Bobby, tell us about Fania Records and what it meant. I mean, I'm listening to this music and I'm just taken right back to being a kid in New York in the 70s. Tell me, I mean, when you hear this, what does it feel? What does it mean to you to hear this?
Well, it's the soundtrack of my life. I grew up in the South Bronx in New York City, and I'm of Puerto Rican heritage. That means I'm a New York Rican. And for us, Fania represented for me, you know, my generation coming up in the music where my parents' generation was the big band sound, mambo, cha-cha-cha, etc. For us, Fania represented more of a sound that was a little bit more contemporary in terms of now the singers became the most important thing. And also it was homegrown, and the identity markers of Fania in terms of the way we play Cuban music in New York City, it became very trombone oriented, solos with the musicians, which was the influence of jazz, etc. It just brings back great memories. You heard Fania recordings in every bodega in New York City when I was growing up. It was the soundtrack of our lives. You couldn't escape it.
You couldn't escape it. It was really just everywhere, and every house party, even today, Christmas, Thanksgiving, you know, when we used to gather, is full of these songs. Felix, when we talk about Johnny Pacheco and we talk about salsa, Johnny Pacheco elevated this music to a level that, it was international. Tell us how he did that.
He was a schooled musician. He had studied at Juilliard, so he was a very, very proficient musician, percussionist, multi-instrumentalist, a fantastic arranger. And when you talk about the Fania sound and you talk about his contribution, it's really he was the architect, one of the principal architects of the sound itself, and the way he arranged the horns, the way he arranged all the rhythm sections, the way he put the songs together, and the way he put the spotlight around this really nice spotlight around whatever vocalist he was working with or instrumentalist he was working with. He worked in the service of others. That's the one thing we need to remember about Johnny Pacheco, that his contribution was making others shine. And that is probably one of the most important things that came out of his relationship with Fania Records.
Bobby, we heard at the very top of the previous segment, we heard a lot of Pacheco songs. I went digging through the crates to get some of these old songs. And one of them was La Esencia del Guaguancó.
Right.
Tell us what the Guaguancó is.
The Guaguancó is a form of rumba. It was the soundtrack also of my life when I was growing up in the South Bronx. It's originally a form that's just voices, drumming, and dancing from La Habana, Cuba, and Matanzas. And the basic melody of Guaguancó from the Havana style is this. And Matanzas style is this. Now you slow that down a little bit and you get. Escucha usted la esencia del guaguancó, which is what you heard there when you played that song. So it was adapted to band styles, and it's one of the forms that we use in salsa, along with the guaracha, the mambo, of course, cha-cha-cha, and the ubiquitous son montuno.
And I want to also, you know, when you're talking about guaguancó, we also talk about the clave, which is the beat that goes with a lot of salsa music. Felix, a lot of this is also deepening the connection that Latinos particularly had with their Afro Caribbean roots. Wasn't that a big part of the creation of salsa, so much that the Fania All-Stars even took the band over to Africa and to Zaire and other countries to perform there? Tell us about that.
It is the essence. It's the bedrock. It's everything about salsa music and what became known as salsa music is that connection to Africa through the clave and through things like the spiritual side of it, the Santeria side and 6/8, what they call 6/8 music forms and stuff like that. And I've always been like so enamored. I'm Mexican American. I'm originally from California. I grew up out there. And I was always enamored by this music. It wasn't part of my soundtrack as a youth. So whenever I saw things like this film that was made in 1974 in Zaire, what always struck me is that it was so powerful that they took the African part of salsa back to Africa and the Africans embraced it. I did an interview I'm spacing on her name right now. I did an interview with an African vocalist who said that she was at that concert and that made her number one embrace salsa even more. But also the fact when she saw Celia Cruz performing with the Fania All-Stars, it empowered her as a woman to be able to be a vocalist and be a strong presence in the music business.
Bobby, let's talk a little bit about a specific instrument, the cuatro. How has that made its way into what we know as salsa?
Oh, well, my good friend, Yomo Toro from Guanica, Puerto Rico, my father's home city, was a master of that instrument. May he rest in peace. I got to perform with it many times. The cuatro is our mandolin-like instrument from Puerto Rico. It originally had four sets of double strings, but in 1952, an artisan put a fifth set of strings. But most people ask me, well, why don't they call it the cinco, which means five, you know? And I say, well, I guess we're conservative as Puerto Ricans. We kept the name cuatro, which means four, you know? But that instrument originally in the song tradition, which is the folk song tradition of Eastern Cuba, which is the foundation of what we call salsa, the tres was the main instrument, which is a mandolin-like sounding guitar from Cuba. It has three sets of double strings. Yomo Toro played that instrument as well, even though he was Puerto Rican, but he decided to bring the cuatro to a session one day, and he always jokes with me. Well, I started going, why didn't you just keep playing the tres? He goes, well, I did in the beginning, but it's the cuatro is smaller, so it's easier to carry, and he started laughing, you know. So, but we're so glad that he did that because it put an identity marker of Puerto Ricanness into the music.
Fania itself is often compared to Motown. Tell us about that comparison.
It's a very accurate comparison. Motown in Detroit, Stax in Memphis, those labels were associated with a particular style of music, a particular community, most importantly. And Fania was the same thing. You're in, you know, one of the biggest cities in the world, New York. And this is not, it's a New York music, but it's a New York music from the Latino barrios, from the Latino community. So it is very specific to New York. Like I said, I'm out in California, and it was like, it was so intriguing to me. I must have an Afro-Caribbean soul or lived in the Afro-Caribbean in the past, because it just drew me in. And that music, everything, you know, we're talking about the 70s. There's no internet, there's no streaming, there's no downloading. I had to wait for these records to come out and absorb them. I had to drive to San Francisco to check them out and buy them. So it reflected this like put the whole idea of the Latin community in New York on this like cloud, this pedestal. Like, well, what it must be like to live in that in the day to day, what you guys experience.
We do. I was a young person there. I was a child, but I remember it. But Bobby, Fania isn't just about the music. There were the clubs, there were the studios. Tell us about that experience. I mean, going to the clubs, I remember watching my aunts getting ready to go out and to dance this music, and it was a thing.
Right. Well, it was ubiquitous. As I said before, you had about 20 to 30 nightclubs in Manhattan alone, where any night of the week, I'm talking about 7 nights a week, you could hear any style in what we call salsa. You could hear a Cuban style conjunto, like in Johnny Pacheco's band, which is two trumpets and a rhythm section. Puente or Machito's band, or Tito Rodriguez's orchestra, which is a big band. You could hear in the charanga style, which is flute and violins. So, and then you had the clubs in the Bronx. The Bronx at one time had as many or as more nightclubs in both jazz and Latin than Manhattan, and then in Brooklyn as well. It was just incredible. And then, you know, thousands of musicians being able to work and live off this, make a living at this, the recording studio, the recording industry. Then you have people, you know, when you go out dancing, you got to get dressed up, etc. So that's part of the industry as well. Clothing, shoes, etc. Then people buying the recordings. So it was an incredible industry that was happening that no longer really exists anymore on the level that it did when I was coming up. So I miss those days fondly. And I must say, the music at the time period gave us sustenance, gave us life, because New York City, as you well know, during that time period in the 70s, was going through a period of malfeasance. The city went bankrupt. It finally imploded in 1977 with the blackout. And what gave us sustenance, let us survive and thrive, it was this music. It was the pulse of New York City.
You're so right about that, Bobby. And Felix, you know, as somebody, you said you didn't grow up in New York, but you still knew about the music. Do you recall how it came out there to California? Was it a similar, you know, were there also people going out to the clubs at that time?
This was, I was still a teenager. I was in high school and I was, you know, a music geek like I am now. And I was just reading, I read about it in the national press. I read about it in Rolling Stone. I had a subscription to Rolling Stone, and it was a different type of magazine back then. And I was intrigued. And honestly, I don't know what attracted me to it. I just remember I went to, salsa was so big that a friend of mine, he started a salsa band like 73, 74, something like that. I was a kid. And I went to go hear him. And I remember walking into the little hall where he was playing. And I heard, Bobby, I heard that piano, that dun, 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 dun. And I'm like, boom, like the sky opened up and everything. And for the longest time, I didn't know what it was called. I just kept calling it that music. I want to hear that music, that music. And then I just, like, I would go to record stores. I would try to find stuff. I found a Puente album. I started to learn how to play congas and timbales because of Santana, but this music drew me in. The first song I learned to play on timbales was El Raton Live from the Yankee Stadium album from the Fania All-Stars, because it was so simple. I had a quarter note cowbell beat, so I could do that, right? It just drew me in, and that's how I found that music. And then I just soaked everything up. When I got to college, I drove to San Francisco. There was a place in San Francisco, Musica Latina, it was like the Tower Records of salsa. I could go in there and pick up as many Fania records as I could take back home.
Bobby, as we sort of wind down this segment, Fania obviously has struck a chord with so many of us of a certain age and a certain era, but how do we keep that spirit of that music alive, particularly as the Puerto Rican and Dominican diaspora shifts and changes? A lot of, you don't hear this music on the radio as much anymore. How do we keep this stuff alive?
Well, I have the philosophy, just like Dizzy Gillespie always said, as long as there's one black person on planet Earth singing the blues, jazz will never die. So as long as there's one Latino person, doesn't have to be Cuban or Puerto Rican, it could be any person, as it could be of any race, as long as one person is playing clave and singing an old Cuban song, this music will never die. But the main thing is the segments like you're doing with us right now, people drawing attention to the music, etc., and also making the connections. I remember when I was in college at the Berklee College of Music, and nobody knew who Tito Puente was or anything like that. And one guy goes to me, a fellow student goes, "Yeah, man, I'm into Santana." And I go, "Well, if you want to find out where those rhythms that Santana is doing, check this out." And I would play him something by Típica 73 or Maestro Tito Puente, etc. And they'd be, you know, same thing with that Felix experience. Their eyes would open up and it was like they were seeing God. Because they would be going, "Oh my God, man, this is like, wow, oh, you know, this, that, and the other." And I go, you see, I'm, you know, so we just have to scream, not scream and shout, but those of us, I've passed on the music to my son, he'll pass it on to his children, et cetera. And we just have to keep, unfortunately with COVID now, this is a dance music. We get together to dance. And with COVID now, unfortunately, we can't really do that. But we can still listen to the music. So listen to Alt Latino, listen to my radio show, listen to WNYC, et cetera, and keep playing the recordings. Keep playing the recordings for
anybody. And when this is all over, Bobby,
And when this is all over, grab a partner and get down, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Felix Contreras is the host of NPR's Alt Latino, and Bobby Sanabria is a multi-Grammy nominated drummer, percussionist, and band leader who works in salsa, jazz, and Latin jazz. Thanks to you both so much for a very fun time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tanzina.
I'm Tanzina Vega. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Haiti is in the middle of a political crisis as its current president refuses to relinquish power. It's an issue that extends back to 2015, when President Jovenel Moïse was elected during a contentious process with allegations of election fraud that consumed the country for more than a year. 5 years later, President Moïse is refusing to step down, claiming his term ends in 2022 and not this year. Demonstrators have since taken to the streets demanding he relinquish power. The U.S. government under President Joe Biden says it supports President Moïse and that protesters and opposition leaders should support the electoral process for the next year. But the protests continue and criminal gangs are controlling the streets across much of the country, pushing Haiti further from a resolution. Jacqueline Charles is a Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald, and she joins us now. Jacqueline, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jacqueline, take us back to 2015. What happened there with the elections that is now being used by the president of Haiti to sort of explain why he's not stepping down?
So Haiti held general elections in 2015, and they were very much marred by violent unrest as well as election fraud. So as a result, the following year, President Michel Martelly, who was in power, he stepped down because his 5 years was up, but he did not have a successor. So we had an interim government that came into power and eventually redid the elections. So President Moïse physically took office in 2017, and there lies the debate. He is saying the Constitution says that a presidential term in Haiti is 5 years. I've only been there 4 years. But his detractors are saying, no, the Constitution also says that the clock on that five-year term starts when the predecessor steps down, which would have been in 2016 with President Martelly. So both sides are reading different articles inside the Haitian Constitution, and they are applying it to their argument. And the United States, the United Nations, and the Secretary General of the OAS have all said that they agree with President Moïse's claim. And Haitians in response have said, when did you become our constitutional court?
Now, what is it that is there something about President Moïse's governance that the protesters are responding to, where they want him out now? Or is this purely a reading of the Haitian Constitution, as we're understanding?
Well, I'll quote you a tweet from Julie Chung, Western Hemisphere Assistant Secretary in the Biden administration, who yesterday, and this is probably one of their tougher tweets or languages, where she says, I am alarmed by recent authoritarian and undemocratic acts from unilateral removals and appointments of Supreme Court judges to attacks against journalists. Respect for democratic norms is vital and non-negotiable. President Moïse has been ruling by decree for over a year, which means that he has no parliament. He dismissed all of the mayors last year. He is just one of 11 elected officials in this entire country of over 11 million citizens. And he has issued dozens, scores of executive decrees, which have basically strengthened his power under the presidency, weakened state institutions, and the latest of which is that he fired three Supreme Court judges and he nominated three others, although it was not done legally and he didn't have the authority to do it in the manner in which he did.
Who is the opposition?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the opposition is not a collective group. It's oppositions. And that's part of their huge problem, is that they have not really been able to coalesce around one group, one agreement on everything. They have put together an accord for a transition. But we have, for instance, former President Aristide, his political party, which was once the most political party in Haiti. While they agree that President Moïse needs to go, they don't necessarily agree with sort of the details on who should step in the interim and how that should happen. So, you know, the international community led by the United States, I mean, they work with this. They point to the fact that the opposition is divided, and they are at odds. And so that has been the problem with them in terms of this whole effort of getting President Moise out. This just didn't happen overnight. I mean, from the minute President Moise came into office, he was contested, and we have seen these waves of unrest. Today, it is centered around a constitutional crisis, but this constitutional crisis is really about a larger political and governance crisis in this country.
What has been the response so far from the federal government, at least in Haiti?
Well, President Moise is the federal government, and he is not ruling with any sort of consensus. And so he controls the courts. The courts this week are objecting his attack on the judiciary, and they've announced that there's a complete shutdown of the court system. But he controls the police. He controls all arms of government. The prime minister is his. And this is what we saw on Sunday. You saw thousands and thousands of Haitians take to the streets saying, we are not going to go back into a dictatorship. We were there 35 years ago. President Moise is trying to bring us back, and we're not going to do that. President Moise has said, I am not a dictator. He sees his mission as to sort of bring Haiti into, you know, the modern era, to stop this cycle of crisis upon crisis. But Haiti's crisis are all built around the electoral process. Every time you talk about elections, we're going to see some sort of crisis. And today, on top of all of the problems this country is facing, you have armed gangs and you have this rampant uptick in kidnappings that are happening. So the question of people asking, you know, while the U.S. is saying you have to go to elections, they're saying, how can anybody even campaign in a situation where armed gangs are terrorizing the population and even school children are being kidnapped off the streets?
And the U.S. government response has been pro-President Moise.
Yes. I mean, he enjoyed widespread support under the Trump administration, and we are seeing the same with the Biden administration. At least they're saying that they support his claim that his term in office does not end until next year. But there is pressure on Biden to change. I mean, we've seen a number of members of Congress that have basically written to Secretary Blinken and asking them to support a transitional government in Haiti. Also within the diaspora, Haitian Americans are also reminding President Biden of his visit to Little Haiti in October. And also 3 weeks later, a tweet where he criticized President Donald Trump and his policy on Haiti. He actually accused him of ignoring Haiti while that country was in a political crisis. So people are reminding the Biden administration of this and saying, hey, what we're seeing is more of the same. We're continuing to see deportations of Haitians to Haiti, and this country is in crisis. It's even a deeper crisis than in October, and your administration is still supporting him. But to be fair, I mean, you know, President Biden still doesn't have his key personnel in place in the Western Hemisphere in the State Department. And right now, the only person really in charge of Latin American policy is Juan Gonzalez at the NSC, and he has his hands full with the migration issue at the southern border.
What are Haitians saying about the U.S. approach right now?
You know, it's mixed. I mean, Haitians always, they go from two things. They go from wanting the U.S. to intervene to saying to the U.S., you have to stay out of our business. I think the biggest issue has been the feeling that the U.S. has been very dismissive of Haitian civil society. I mean, we have the Catholic Church, you have the Federation of Haitian Bars, you have the administrative offices of the judiciary, all have said that President Moise's term ends next year. And you have the United States and others taking a position, but really haven't taken into account their opinions or even sat down with members of Haitian civil society. Put the opposition aside for a minute, but institutions, civil society. And we even saw with the Trump administration where they publicly attacked Haitian civil society. So Haitians feel that the United States has basically been completely dismissive and treat them with a certain disdain in this matter. And so that is creating a reaction on the ground where they're basically saying that, you know, why is it that every time we have our internal politics, it is a matter of international debate of sort of big brother telling us what we need to do. Yet at the same time, they want that big brother, the blonde, the foreigner, to come in and save the day.
And how is the Haitian diaspora responding to this, Jacqueline?
Well, you are starting to see movement in diaspora that feels very much in terms of how their family members in Haiti feel. I mean, for the Haitian diaspora, what happens in Haiti is very much a domestic issue for them because they're still tied to that country. And they are also reminding President Biden of his visit and his promise and him courting Haitian American voters. And they also want President Biden to step in for the U.S. to try and figure out this. And the real debate, I think, too, is this, you know, is it elections that Haiti should be pushing for, or is it a transitional government? The history of this country is every time there's elections, there's always a crisis. And today you're in a crisis that did not come after, a transitional government. It came after an election. But the United States always supports elections because that's part of democracy. That's part of the definition. But it's going to be interesting to see at the end of the day, is it that Haitians who end up resolving this, or is it going to require foreign intervention or some special envoy from the United States that goes in and really tries to get both sides to sit and to agree?
Jacqueline Charles is the Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for our show today. We made it halfway through the week. Hope you enjoyed it. If you missed anything or you want to listen back again, check out our podcast. You can download that wherever you find your podcasts, or you can head over to thetakeaway.org. And of course, if you have any thoughts or show ideas, send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. I'm at Tanzina Vega. And you can also send us your voice memos. Record those on your phone and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. And leave your take there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. And we'll see you tomorrow.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.